All right, tonight, a somewhat, shall we say, emotion-laden presentation. Because who can possibly talk about monuments, specifically Civil War monuments, without getting downright emotional? It's impossible to do. You might as well be talking about your own family after coming. People get that riled up about it. And so that's the actual, that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. So we're going to talk about what the Bible has to say about monuments. Turns out it has an awful lot to say about monuments. And we're not even going to be able to touch all of it. It's something that we could probably take, actually, four or five sessions on. But we'll just obviously take one. Monuments, blessings, or curses. Now, I went through and fixed all those except for my title page. So I do understand grammar and syntax and whatnot, and as we move forward, you'll be able to see that I did get the S on the end there. How do you feel about this guy? Yes, and that would be Bobby Lee. And of course, we pretty much all know. See, this how you separate the people that know a little bit about the war and the reasons for it, I say, from those that don't. It's not that you know his name, it's that you know his name, right? Those of you that are interested in it, you know that his horse's name was Traveler. And if you don't know that, then I'm going to arbitrarily place you in the noob northern camp and not knowing enough, as you should, about the war between the states. Now, I want to see if I get the emotion. I don't know if this is a good idea or not. I want to see if I get the emotion out of the way in the beginning. All right, we're gonna deal directly with the North South thing. There's no way I can stand up here and pretend that we're gonna deal with monuments and not deal with the North South problem issue that came up again and again. That's the one that's emotional, and we all know that when the emotions, well, put it this way, emotions can get in the way of good, can get in the way of good and proper communication. So, first of all, from Ben House, writing in the Chalcedon Report back in 2000, talking about the abolitionists. And, well, just read what he has to say. The abolitionists, I'll give you a little heads up, he's not real sympathetic towards them. He says, the abolitionists were religious folk too. They were the sons and rebel heirs of the Puritan fathers of the Old and New England. They trimmed the edges of the hardy Puritanism that was theirs to inherit, whittling away at such theology as the Trinity, the original sin, the deity of Christ. They adorned themselves with the wolfishly fashionable theological idols of their times. Theological liberalism, Unitarianism, Transcendentalism. They cursed the Constitution and the flag when it protected the slaveholding South. But they divinized, they made a god of the state, and assumed that the tramping and pillaging of the Union Army represented God's truth going marching on. And he goes on to say, parenthesis, and to think some Christians still sing that anthem. My guess is everyone in this room has sung that anthem at one time or another. There'll be an invitation later. The abolitionists, who largely consisted of apostate New England Puritan rebels, held in typical heretical fashion to certain biblical doctrines with additional twists. At the center of their heresy was the idea of creating the perfect society inhabited by perfected men, perfected, of course, by adhering to the latest New England impulse. They spawned utopias, promoted free love and the feminist movement, and advanced the idea of secular government schools. The abolitionists twisted the biblical doctrines of sanctification and glorification in the millennial kingdom to create a militant millennianarianism. We cannot, in this article, begin the refutation of the abolitionist creed. We will stand against slavery with the very same words that the Old and New Testaments used to attack the sin of slavery. Let the hearer understand, the others can search their concordances. We will state our opposition to the enslavement of the black man, but will add to our opposition the enslaving of all Americans via the IRS, drafting men for foreign police actions, and the imposition of government schools. Stiff words from a defender, if you will, of what many would call the Old South. Other places in the article, he does something that needs to be done every time you talk about the slavery issue. And he makes a distinction between the abolitionist societies and the anti-slavery societies. That's an important distinction you must make if you're ever going to study this this topic. The anti-slavery societies, many of them existed in the South, where Presbyterianism still was strong. It's not a real nice, clean break between the two, but I think he's got a fair point there. Now, that's a defender of the South there. Anybody here know who Cecil Rhodes was? Anybody follow the controversy that went on recently in South Africa surrounding Cecil Rhodes? Yeah, they had their own little monument removal movement. Interestingly enough, a little bit prior to ours going on here. Cecil Rhodes, you might not have heard of Cecil Rhodes, but you've heard of Rhodesia, right? Cecil Rhodes had a rocky 2015. He died in 1902 at the age of 48. His last words, according to Lore, were, "So little done, so much to do." He did a lot in that relatively brief life. He made British colonialism boom in southern Africa. He also made a fortune in diamonds, and when he died, he left that fortune to a variety of public works. He never married or had children. In this, he was like Alfred Nobel, and they wrote similar wills. Rhodes was a racist, certainly in the sense he believed that he and his fellow British were the superior race. He wanted to bring the whole world under its aegis. His ambition did not include the recovery of the United States, as he put it. Back to his rocky 2015, or to his will. First, he left the University of Cape Town, the land on which its main campus now sits, and this is Cape Town, here. The land on which the main campus now sits, there is accordingly a statue of Rhodes on that land, or was. For decades, people grumbled about the statue, and this very much included Afrikaners, who resented Rhodes as a symbol and leader of their enemy, the British. Let's just pause there very briefly. If you know about the history of South Africa, it's not just a white-black thing. The Afrikaners, the original Dutch, despised the British, and the British despised the Dutch. And it goes back to the Boer War, fought a little over 100 years ago, and bitter little, nasty little thing that saw the introduction, in a modern sense, of concentration camps. So Cecil Rhodes, an Englishman, being not appreciated by the Dutch. In March 2015, students, and this is going to sound downright American, in March 2015, students at the university decided the statue of Rhodes at last had to go. Or as they put it in their hashtag, Rhodes must fall. Did they go about the protest in an orderly, logical, civilized way? Don't be silly. Students don't have the time or patience for that now. First, they smeared excrement on the statue, human excrement. Then they occupied a university building, making numerous demands. And they revived an old radical slogan, one settler, one bullet. Needless to say, they got their way. Was there any doubt? Within a month, the statue was felled, and the students had a new Black Studies program. 8 months later, in December, the Rhodes Must Fall movement moved to Oxford. This was Rhodes' alma mater. He attended one of its colleges, Oriel, in the 1870s. On his death, he left the university a great deal of money, some of which was used for building at Oriel, the Rhodes building. It has a modest statue of the donor. This is the Rhodes that must fall. There was also money for the scholarships, of course. I think you'll recognize this, what's coming next. The famous Rhodes Scholarships, which have gone now to almost 8,000 people. Rhodes wanted to help students who had, among other things, moral force of character and instincts to lead. Our Bill Clinton was a recipient, you might recall. And of course, we can say today, he had half of that, right? Remember, Rose wanted to give the money to other folks who had moral force of character and instinct to lead. Bill Clinton definitely was halfway there. He definitely had the instinct to lead in some sense or another. Now, why did I read all this? Well, one of the reasons why we have the Middle-Angle Reformation Society, one of the big reasons why we do what we do, is our motto is think and reform. And yes, we do say without apology that there is a dearth, an epidemic, if you will, of non-thinking. Because we have North America, many Christians, thinking that we need to take down these monuments because somebody was a racist, their own slaves. Really? We better start thinking, folks. Can you read it? The origin of species by means of natural selection. Can you see it there? Some of you know what's coming next. Yeah. Let's see if we get a little closer here. Or, the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. Racist terminology, anybody? Don't tell me we don't have statues of him in every pathetic science department in North America here in our state-sponsored schools. And there we are, listening to the media and who knows who else, telling us that we have to pull down all these statues because they're racist. Tell you what, Bobby Lee and Stonewall Jackson and Jeb Stuart, not to mention our other guy, I can't remember his name now, the guy that went from private to general, the only guy in either side that went from private to general in the entire war. In the South. I can't remember his name. Anyway, he always gets hit with the art hashtag. They said some things and perhaps maybe did some things that we can now call racist. I can tell you this with confidence. Their most famous work, whatever it was, had nothing like this in it. Preservation of favored races. In the struggle for life, Charles Darwin. So let's, at the very beginning, let's stop with this idea that we have a problem with these guys because they were racist. And oh no, we're not racist, we're better than that. Well, I tell you what, I got some nominations for some books you can burn and from statues you can take down. Anything by this guy, if you're really serious about racism. Alright, moving on. For our purposes, that's our emotional outburst for the evening. We're not quite done yet. For our purposes, we will treat a monument as basically a large symbol. Right away, we want to ask four questions. Number one, is it possible to communicate without symbols? Talk about communication all the time. We have to work together. Is it possible to communicate without symbols? And I'm saying that monuments are basically large symbols. Basically. I don't think you can do that exclusively, but basically. Okay. Number two, is societal life possible without symbols? Have you ever heard of a society anywhere that had no symbology to it? Thirdly, are symbols worthy of protection? That has to do with our main question here. And number four, what is the definition of a symbol? Now we'll get to these, but I want to take you to this here. Okay? Our first question, is it possible to communicate without symbols? Is what I have up there, is that a symbol? It's actually three symbols, right? See, we're used to thinking of words versus symbols. But letters themselves are put together to form words, and letters themselves are symbols, are they not? Now, if I had a picture of the sun up there, that is the sun. No different from what we have here. Both are communicating to you through symbols. Now, we're going to define symbols. A two- or three-dimensional form that represents something other than the form itself. Symbols are usually, but not always, visual, and are used to convey other ideas and beliefs that often have nothing to do with the symbol itself. For example, we're going to take you all, you're going to be archaeologists 1,000 years from now, okay? And you come across this. And of course you're all going to think, oh, that means something like computers and whatnot, right? You're not going to have any idea at all. See, we have this Apple thing going on here. But this is not about an apple. It's not about fruit or fruit trees. This is the symbol of a giant electronics company, if I can say it that way. It's a symbol. It represents something that's not the symbol itself. Who remembers this guy? I miss him. One of the coolest icons ever was Joe Camel. Now, can you really tell what that's about if you don't bring an awful lot to that? You see this is the power of symbols that are beyond words. See, you can, and they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. That talk about these types of symbols. You're bringing an awful lot to this right here. You're saying that this is what's communicating. That if you smoke these cigarettes, these Camel cigarettes, you can be as cool as a leather jacket wearing Camel or something like that. I mean, come on, can we talk? It is cool. Right? The Pillsbury Doughboy. What's this represent? Excuse me. This is 2017. The Pillsbury Dough person. I mean, if anybody's gender neutral, it's gotta be this thing. People represent the things you cook and things you heat up. Now, the way I did this originally, I have a larger picture here, and I don't know why it made it small. The section you're going to probably see, but you'll be able to figure it out. You probably can, you know this guy here, right? Yeah. There's just no way, as the archaeologist from 1,000 years from now, you're going to look at this, you have no context whatsoever, right? And figure out that this is about preventing forest fires? with global warming, it'd be nothing but the ocean anyway. There's no way you're going to know that. Mrs. Head, you'll recognize the Michelin man. Tires. You're going to get tires out of that? It got too small there for stopping. An eight-sided red octagon represents stop. You know this. If you don't know this, if you're coming from AD, how about this next one? Here's where the emotions will come back. To us, this represents oppression, murder, bloodshed, theft, and raw state power. That was what it represents to us. Does it represent that to everybody? For those Bolsheviks and their children, it represented freedom, equality, opportunity, and justice. You see what we're doing here when we're talking about symbols and ultimately monuments. It's hard to talk about because so much is brought to it. Blessings or curses? Well, now monuments, as mentioned, are pretty much large symbols, as we said before. Again, any symbol, generally speaking, is by definition a representative of something that is often completely different from the thing symbolized. Once again, think, for example, of the Christian fish or the apple symbol. We are always called to consider the substance represented by the symbol. Right? You see the Christian fish. You don't think fish. You think Jesus Christ, God's Son, Savior, or you should. You know how that's how that developed, right? The Greek first letters of Jesus Christ, God's Son, Savior, it was an acrostic, or an acronym, if you will, and that was Yoda, Chi, Theos, Weos, Soter. The first letters of all of those spelled Ichthus, which was the Greek word for fish. So, interestingly enough, when we go back all the way to Christ, it seems like the pagans now picked up symbology a lot more than we have. But symbology, once again, started not with the pagans. They couldn't think of it. It started with the Christians. Of course, we've managed to abandon it. Now, let's consider some symbols that are strictly Christian in their origin. I say origin because they may no longer be connected with Christianity in general, thanks to our abandonment of them, or the scriptures in particular. Some may be stated explicitly in scripture, while others may have arisen through necessity, eventually representing explicit Christian concepts. Now, of course, I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to go to the easiest one, the one you'll recognize first of all here. Question. Is this any longer a Christian symbol? The reason why it's not, or it's not perceived as such, it is. But the reason why it's not perceived as such is because we no longer care about symbols at all. You know, in this time that we always talk about preaching the gospel, communication, how many books in your local Christian bookstore are all about communication? Okay, I'm in favor of communication. I try to do that every day myself. But how in the world can we be gabbing on and on about communication and deliver up to the perverts and the sodomites this symbol? It can only be because we are really serious about communicating much of anything. God says, I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign or symbol of a covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. It's not just in Genesis. First book, the rainbow, last book, from Revelation 4:3. And he who sat there was like a jasper and sardius stone in appearance, and there was a rainbow around the throne in appearance like an emerald. Revelation 10:1, I saw another mighty angel coming down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was on his head. His face was like the sun, and his feet like pillars of fire. We haven't just given up our rainbow symbol to the pagans as far as God's covenant between him and between God and the earth. We've actually given up the symbol of God himself. And of course, we congratulate ourselves on being good Christians, I suppose, because far be it from us to ever, get into a little tiff over a symbol. Meanwhile, speaking of giving up symbols, have you noticed the mass exodus from even the word Christian? Have you noticed this? In some circles, it's now becoming a follower of Christ. Because, we can't hang on to that particular terminology. because, you know, some people are misrepresenting Christianity. So I don't want to be a Christian anymore. I'll be a follower of Christ. And of course, here at Mars, we're very sensitive about things because, generally speaking, when you hear follower of Christ, you know what I hear? Old Testament by the boards. That's what I hear. How about this one? What are you thinking when you see this? There's so much going on here. I wish I had the rest of the picture. I don't know why. I thought I copied it right, but I didn't. Yeah, that's an old pictograph, if you will, of Jacob's ladder. Now, Jacob's ladder represented something, did it not? It was a dream. And if all we had was Jacob's dream, he has a dream, he sees this ladder, and the angels ascending and descending, that might not mean a whole lot to us. But we have Christ in the New Testament, right? In the book of John, pointing out that that was a symbol, that was representative. This ladder, Christ said in explicit terms, represented Christ himself. Yes, the ladder, okay, not that ladder, but the ladder that Jacob saw in his vision, that represented Christ. How about this one? Yeah, that brass snake that people looked at in Numbers under Moses. Of course, we know what happened to it after a while, right? Yeah, they kept it. And Nehemiah had to come along a little later on and called it the Hushtan, or that little brass thing, or that perhaps that annoying brass thing. And they threw it out because people began to worship it. Now let's stop there for a minute. Let's stop there. Have you heard some saying that we need to get rid of all monuments because we might worship them? Or some people accuse people of worshiping statues of Bob. I don't know anybody who worships a statue of Bobby Lee, or maybe somebody does, I don't know. I know for me, having a statue of Oliver Cromwell in my bedroom might be a dangerous thing. I'm kidding. I hope I am. You see, this became a problem when it was worshipped. But it was not a problem when it was not. So, if it is true that what Marx said was, if Marx is correct, the first battlefields to rewrite history, then I submit to you that we have lost a good portion of our Christian history simply because we have not cared enough to interpret even some of the most basic historical symbols displayed in the most prominent national emblems, national flags. Have you ever given thought to how many national flags contain a cross? A cross. Now, you might argue about some Christian symbols, whether that's actually Christian. The fish, it's hard to argue against that one. But one you can't argue against is the cross, right? I mean, the cross is such an offensive thing. And nobody's going to put a cross up unless they're, one, trying to fake somebody else out, or two, they really believe it because it's an offensive symbol. The cross. This, of course, would be, if I recognize it, what country? That'd be Australia. Is that pretty prominent? How about Denmark? This is easy. It's the Swiss. We see that all the time, right? Also probably pretty easy. Scotland, right? St. Andrew's Cross. Here's one you won't get. Russian naval flag. See, the Russians have a Christian history as well. And we stand around and we get kowtowed and bullied by people who say there's no Christian history anywhere. When all around, especially in the West, the most visible symbol, I mean, come on, let's face it, right, folks? There's nothing more visible as a symbol than the national flag, right? Nothing. And all over these flags are these symbols. Well, let's move on here. How about this? This is going to be a little bit hard to see. PA State Supreme Court. You can't see here at the bottom. That's hard to see. But across the bottom, see, this is kind of like a pictogram of heaven. It says across the bottom here, this is in the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court. It says across the bottom, forever, O Lord, your word, or thy word, is settled in heaven. What do we have here? It's kind of like the Ten Commandments. More? That's also State Supreme Court. How about this? You recognize this. Some of you know where this is, right? U.S. Supreme... United States Supreme Court. Now, I always forget who these yahoos are. I forget. This guy here looks like a modern Gothic version of, you know, something like the public school. But you know who that is, right? As soon as you see this, right? That, of course, would be Moses. Now, let's stop here and think about this for a second. Anybody want to tell me what in the world Moses is doing in our separated church and state Supreme Court building? Doesn't look too separated. The only thing separated is a first and second tables. Here's the thing. Here's why I opened the way I did. If you think that the people tearing down the monuments of Lee, Jackson, Forrest, that's what I was trying to think of, David Bedford Forrest, might not have been the best guy in the world. I don't know. I don't know enough about him. Stewart. If you think they're going to stop with those monuments and leave this alone, you're out of your mind. You're not thinking. And you have no idea what the real battle's about here. It's not about racism. It never was and it never is. It's always about who gets to be sovereign. Don't forget that, my friends. Every time there is a conflict between Christians and pagans, at the end of it all, it's a conflict of who gets to be sovereign, God or man. Every time. That's what's behind this. Let's talk about memorials, monuments versus idols here. And this is not a real strict separation, but I want to talk briefly about what we see in the Bible. And I want to go to a passage that Joshua 22, we'll talk about that in a minute. I want to talk about the difference between, generally speaking, when you see things built, public symbols built in the Bible, they're memorials, generally speaking, when done properly. And when the pagans do it, they're idols. Okay? Both are public symbols. Both are meant to unite. Both are meant to communicate. Big difference between a memorial and an idol. I'm going to say that the memorials of the Bible are about providence. Generally speaking, they're unimpressive in appearance, and they direct the observer to a God-centered solution. Think for a minute of Samuel and the altar of Ebenezer, right? Hitherto has the Lord helped us. He builds an altar. Remember Jacob? Jacob did the same thing. Remember what the rules were about building altars that Moses laid down? One of the rules was that you could not have a hammer or a chisel. It had to be built with natural stone. Now, why is that? I mean, it's going to look a lot better. It's going to be a lot more pleasing to the eye. I agree if we can just, like, get the hammer and chisel out and make it look attractive a little bit. But God did not want them to be directed towards the skill and the altar. He wanted them to be able to see beyond the altar and what it memorialized, if you will. That's what was behind it. Now, the idols, generally speaking, pagan idols are about power. They're impressive in appearance. And they direct the observer to a man-centered solution. Again, think of what we see throughout the Bible. Think of even what we see now. USSR, Cuba, even. Communist China? Do they have like little tiny little symbols here and there, hard to find, statues of Stalin, Lenin, Mao, Castro? Not at all. Huge, overwhelming, dominating statues to remind you of how little you are and how you must look to the great leader for your salvation. And there we have, I think, the crux of the matter here. Monuments are generally speaking, since they're religious in nature, generally speaking, they're about a savior somewhere. Whether Christian or not, they're about a savior at some point. More on that a little bit later. Now, in case you don't believe me, which one of those is more impressive? Hint, not the one on the left, right? Nebuchadnezzar knew how to make an impressive statue. I think people there might be reminded who's boss. They see that thing. Really, he's not the first guy to make one. I mean, he might be the first guy to make one that big. He certainly isn't the last. If any of you followed what happened during the fall of the Iron Curtain, so see some of the size of some of those statues of Lenin and Stalin that started coming down? Mostly Lenin, because they were the ones who were left over. Some of the Stalin statues already come down. They're huge things. I mean, huge. It's one of the things that annoys me, frankly, about the Lincoln Memorial. There's plenty to be annoyed about that, but the size of the thing is annoying in itself. Okay. Joshua 22 has all the drama connected with the fight over public symbols. We have a near civil war, a negotiated end, an offended party, an offensive party, and a conflict that really had no antagonist. And now here's where I want to discuss what the Bible, this is a somewhat neglected passage in the Bible. Most of us, you know, I mean, it's just kind of like one of those passages we just kind of go past and say, what? That was kind of weird. They almost killed each other over this thing. Let me just read the passage to you and talk about it just really, really briefly. This is after the Israelites had pretty much done the job they were supposed to do, pretty much. And things have settled down. Joshua's getting up there in years, and he's going to pass the baton on. Then Joshua called the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh and said to them, "You have kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, and have obeyed my voice in all that I commanded you. You have not left your brethren these many days up to this day, but have kept up the charge and commandment of the Lord your God. And now the Lord your God has given you rest to your brethren as he promised them. Now therefore return and go to your tents and to the land of your possession, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of the Jordan." Key comment there, on the other side of the Jordan. You may recall that the land of Israel was supposed to be on this side of the Jordan, if you will. That's where it was supposed to be divided up. But you may recall that the Gadites, the Reubenites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they saw that the land was good on the other side of the Jordan. They asked Moses, or Joshua, I can't remember Moses or Joshua, they asked if they could stay on that side. And they were told, if you help the other tribes clean out the Canaanites on this side, you can come back and stay here. I mean, a bad military move. They didn't have the protection of the Jordan River, and they were exposed to attack, especially from the Ammonites, and that happened later on in the book of 1 Samuel. And Saul had to go save them. It was not an easily defensible position. Nevertheless, that's where they wanted to be. And Joshua's here saying, you did your job, you can go back now to the place where you want to go, on the other side of Jordan. But he says, take careful heed to do the commandment and the law which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, and keep his commandments, to hold fast to him, and to serve him with all your heart, with all your soul. So Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their tents. Now to the half-tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given a possession of Bashan, and to the other half of it, Joshua gave a possession among their brethren on this side of the Jordan, westward. And indeed, when Joshua sent them away to their tents, he blessed them and spoke to them, saying, return with much, much riches, etc. So they go back. Now they're back across, they're back home, and this is what happens next. And this is just kind of such a bizarre thing, you have to take notice of it, because it seems like everything's good, everything's peaceful. Hey, you guys go there and settle. You guys go there and settle. And I'll, you know, Joshua, I'm done. I'm retiring now. And everything should have been peaceful. But we have a problem. And when they came to the region of the Jordan, which is in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half tribe Manasseh, built an altar there by the Jordan, a great, impressive altar. Now the children of Israel heard someone say, "Behold, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, they built an altar on the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region of the Jordan on the children of Israel's side." And when the children of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered together at Shiloh to go to war against them. Apparently it wasn't enough to clean out the Canaanites. I guess they had bigger fish to fry here. Wait a minute. We're going to go to war over an altar? Apparently. Then the children of Israel sent Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest of the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, the half-tribe of Manasseh, into the land of Gilead. And with them 10 rulers, one ruler from each of the chief house of every tribe of Israel, and each one was the head of the house of his father among the divisions of Israel. Then they came to the children of Reuben, to the children of Gad, and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, to the land of Gilead, and they spoke with them, saying, "Thus says the whole congregation of the Lord." A little offensive there, right? Thus says the whole congregation of the Lord. Kind of like we're talking for the real congregation of the Lord, you know, the one on that side of Jordan, not you. I want you to see how offensive this was. "What treachery is this that you have committed against the God of Israel and turn away this day from following the Lord, and that you have built for yourselves an altar that you might rebel this day against the Lord?" So the iniquity of Peor, that was a problem back in Numbers 25. Is it not enough for us, from which we are not cleansed till this day, although there was a plague in the congregation of the Lord, but that you must turn away this day from following the Lord? It shall be, if you rebel today against the Lord, that tomorrow he will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. Nevertheless, if the land of your possession is unclean, then cross over to the land of the possession of the Lord, where the Lord's tabernacle stands, and take possession among us. Do not rebel against the Lord, nor rebel against us, by building yourselves an altar besides the altar of the Lord our God. They have to know what's happening there is, God had said through Moses that I'm going to set my altar in Shiloh. And so what's happening here is, before we get too upset with the 10 tribes, they saw that altar as a religious act. They saw the monument as a religious symbol, as all monuments are. And they couldn't stand an alternate religious symbol. And so you can't blame them for how they're feeling about this. Because Phinehas goes on to say, "Did not Achan, the son of Zerah, commit a trespass and the accursed thing, and wrath fell on all the congregation of Israel? And that man did not perish alone in his iniquity." Thanks a lot, guys. You're going to rebel against God already. Don't you remember the last time this kind of thing happened? We all took it on the chin just because of one guy, so stop it already. Now, don't forget the intensity of this situation. The reason why these guys, these ten reps and Phinehas are even there to begin with is because they want to go to war on the other side of the Jordan. I don't know what it'd be like to get off, you know, to get sent off. Hey, Joel. We want to go to war. We want to wipe out these people. But before we do it, why don't you go over there and see if you can settle things down? How do you think that would go over? You're either going to get a war, or you're going to look like you backed off. Right? You're going to look like, you came to this negotiated peace, but you had to give it up. You let them keep their altar. That's why they sent Phinehas, right? There's the one guy they knew that could definitely handle a difficult situation. Yeah, it's that Phinehas that stopped the plague when the Moabites were intermarrying with the Israelites. And there was Phinehas watching the end of the Israelite nation. which would have destroyed the Israelite nation if they would have been able to continue to intermarry. You may recall it was Phinehas when a Moabite and an Israelite went into a tent in front of everybody, just to thumb their nose, if you will, at God and at Moses and everybody else. Phinehas went in with the spear and solved the problem. So they know that Phinehas knows how to negotiate. Okay. Next. Then the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half tribe of Manasseh answered and said to the heads of the division of Israel. Now, I want you to hear this. This is what I want you to hear. Because as we wrap up our presentation tonight, I want you to hear how they went past all the offensive language and right to the heart of the issue, something that we seem to not be able to do today. Okay? They're going to talk strictly about the issue. Not about, hey, you know, why are you coming telling us what to do? Who do you think you are crossing and telling us what to do? We're going to build an altar if we want to, and it's none of your business. Listen to what they say. Children of Reuben, children of Gad, half tribe of Manasseh, answered and said to the heads of the division of Israel, "The Lord God of gods, the Lord God of gods, he knows, and let Israel itself know, if it is in rebellion or if it is in treachery against the Lord, do not save us this day. Go ahead and kill us, if that's what we're doing. If we have built ourselves an altar to turn from following the Lord, or if to offer on it burnt offerings or grain offerings, or if to offer peace offerings on it, let the Lord himself require an account. But in fact, we have done it for fear, for reason, saying, in time to come, your descendants may speak to our descendants, saying, what have you to do with the Lord God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan a border between you and us. You children of Reuben and children of Gad, you have no part in the Lord. So your descendants would make our descendants cease from fearing the Lord. Therefore we said, let us now prepare to build ourselves an altar, not for burnt offering nor for sacrifice, but that it may be a witness between you and us and our generations after us, that we may perform the service of the Lord before him with our burnt offerings, with our sacrifices, with our peace offerings, that your descendants may not say to our descendants in time to come, you have no part in the Lord. Therefore we said that it will be, when they say this to us, or to our generations in time to come, that we may say, here is the replica of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, though not for burnt offerings nor for sacrifices, but it is a witness between you and us. You see what's happening? They understand symbology. They understand that there's a river between the two. And they're setting up an altar not to separate themselves from the rest of the Israelites, but to connect themselves with it. Now, and we, you know, you read the rest of the chapter, Phinehas accepted that. In fact, it was very encouraging of their response. Now, think about this for a second. It's the same altar. It's one altar, right? But the interpretation was completely different on either side. So intense that they were going to go to war over. They were about to go from 12 tribes to 10. In a sense, 13 tribes, sort of. Tribe of Levi is kind of difficult to put in that. We ask the question, monuments, blessings, or curses? Well, I'm going to say this, that if monuments point back to providence and a godly heritage and bring them on, but if they point to a man-centered solution, the terror of man, then destroy them all. Of course, somebody can say, wait a minute, Joel, okay, well, what do we do about Lee and so forth? Well, I'll say this. The Confederate flag and so forth. I'll just say this about the Confederate flag. If you believe the St. Andrew's cross is a real cross, and I believe it was, and it is, which of the two flags actually have the symbology of the cross? Just a thought. I'll tell you something else, too. I see this all the time. In fact, the article by Nordlinger there that I read from National Review about Rhodes, he went on and on about slavery and how so good that the South lost over slavery.
As if we no longer have slavery. Come on, pay attention. You think there's no such thing as slavery anymore?
When you work from January through June? Are you kidding me? But I think it's actually sort of kind of worse than that, if you will. In this sense, let me ask this question. You got a call from your Aunt May, or Mabel. There's a problem in Iowa. You got to go for 3 days. You have to leave your children with somebody. And your choices are Bobby Lee or any one of those Antifa yahoos that are pulling down a statue. Serious business, folks. Who are you going to leave them with? You see, the real offense of at least some of these Southerners is they're godly people. That's the real offense. That is always religious, my friends. So I'm going to answer monuments, blessings, and curses by once again pointing out what do they point back to. They're always going to be religious at some level. Let me go back to Ben House as we wrap up. He says this. In the meantime, concerning the Confederate flag and other portions of the Confederate heritage, we recommend the following. Fight for the cause of the flag, etc., but not at the expense of the more important principles. Maintaining a godly family, having a doctrinally sound church, educating your children in a Christian day school or homeschool, spreading the gospel, and other aspects of the Christian life are more important than arguing over a flag waving over some small portion of Dixieland. Here's what I want to say about the Southerners who want to preserve the statues. Why are you really fighting this battle? I mostly call them frauds and fakes. I'll tell you why. Because having lost to the Northern Army, they then turned their children over to be educated by that same Northern Army. And now we're surprised that they want to take down our monuments. Should have given them your children. And you can stop now. But the largest Protestant denomination, the Southern Baptist Convention, every year at their convention, they have Bruce Short or someone else bring up a resolution to encourage everyone to get their kids out of the public school. And of course, it gets voted down every time. It doesn't even make it to the floor ever. The Southern Baptist Convention. Meanwhile, those same people going out and trying to defend the monuments. Talk about a waste. If you would have given your kids over 100 years ago, you wouldn't have a problem today. By the way, it's a whole lot more than monuments that are at stake. It's the entire country. I'll close by saying this. Remember Elijah when he was in the cave and God comes to him? God says, what are you doing? Remember what Elijah says? I'm paraphrasing. He says, they've torn down your altars and they've killed your prophets. And I'm the only one that's left. See, Elijah understood the symbology of the altars. He knew that they weren't going to kill the prophets first. They're going to tear down the altars first. And then they're coming for the prophets. Shame on us for not understanding the importance of symbols. That's really my major point tonight. It's not so much what should be done with the statues. It's more a message of understanding the importance of symbols and how they speak. Because they're all throughout the scriptures and they're all throughout the world, and we are whistling Dixie when we just shrug our shoulders and say, it's just a symbol. My friends, when it's public and it's big, that's noticeable, it's never just a symbol, never. Who's the question? Yeah, Luke.
What are your thoughts on the Statue of Liberty and Mount Rushmore? What their future is, and would you think it's okay that they're still standing?
Yeah, I think it's fine that it's still standing. I could do without Teddy Roosevelt. Actually, I could do without some of those guys on there. Quite frankly, T.R. is one of them. Jefferson, I could do without him too. But it's not a symbol of worship, if you will. It's a symbol of history. These guys were our presidents. To me now, it's more a symbol of artistic capability than it is anything else. That's, to me, what's impressive about it, at least. Someone else is going to bring something else to it. But the time will come. It will come when those Mount Rushmore will be defaced. It will happen. By the way, next on the list is definitely Columbus. Did you see that some of our colleges, not surprising, are considering renaming some of their halls that are named after guys like Jefferson and Washington and so forth, trying to rename them. The other thing you asked about was the Statue of Liberty. I don't think that has too much of a future either. It'll be a racist symbol. And see, that's the thing that I react against the most, is the hypocrisy of the people who use the R word. But again, when was the United States of America such a country when it really did welcome immigrants? And what will happen is it'll be seen as a monument to imperialism when the United States was not imperial. Now the United States is very imperial. The United States is an empire-building entity right now. There's no question about that. And the same people are going to have a problem with what they're going to call the Statue of Liberty. They're going to call that imperial and ignore what's going on now. I mean, have an idea how many wars we got going on right now? I don't even know. And why? It's not for any moral reason that I know of. Like most of our wars, quite frankly. Not all. Most. By the way, do you know the longest peace period in our history was? I'm talking about the colonial era and the era of post-1776. Do you know when the longest peaceful period was? It's during the time of the folks that everybody really hates. The Pilgrims and the Puritans. They had peace with the local Indians for 60 years, and we have not had that amount of peace time since. And so the very people, of course, who are all about Native American rights or whatever, they hate the people. And you know, they hate the Puritans, Pilgrims. They hate them. They're such hypocrites. And it's not well known. I did not know this until I read Saints and Strangers. Do you remember who wrote that book, Sweets? I always forget the name of that author. Written in 1945. The best book on the whole Pilgrim's history. I didn't know this, but they set up courts for justice. And Indians testified in those courts. And if there was an offense done against an Indian by a European, that European got punished. The Indians had tremendous trust in these Puritans. It was 60 years later after the Pilgrims got here, King Philip's War was called. Peace for 60 years, we haven't done since. But who are the bad guys in American history? I think I know. That would be the Puritans. If we can't see the hypocrisy, we'll never get it. We just never will. All right. think I went a little long tonight. Almost an hour. Who else has a question? See, this one you're always sorry because it went a little longer. This is when you get the top of the question.
Oh, wow.
But you said. That's why we do this.
What about the verses that talk about not moving the ancient landmarks? I know some of it has to do with property, not moving the neighbors, but there's a verse or two that actually called the ancient. Is that strictly for trying to steal someone's property by moving their...
I've always seen that as a strict property delineation there. I've always seen that. Landmark, a mark that marks the land, if you will. I've never really seen it as more than that. Someone else might have some insight on that. I've never seen it as any more than that. Again, the Israelites were, they weren't big on public symbols too much. Again, the public symbols that they had, I mean, they had the tabernacle, but even that was not a hugely impressive thing. Solomon's temple certainly was. But that was a little bit different animal in that they were tied to Jerusalem. Under the Old Testament covenant economy, if you will, you traveled to Jerusalem, you made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And so you had this edifice. But for the most part, they didn't do this. And, you know, it's interesting that later on, you mentioned this problem between the three tribes on the other side of the Jordan. Later on, you might remember Jeroboam figured it out. Remember, Jeroboam was promised an enduring house like David. But you might remember what he did. The first thing he did was he set up two golden calves because he saw the religious nature of monuments. And he said, you know what? I can't have the people up in my 10 tribes, my area, going down to Jerusalem to worship. I'm going to lose them. I won't get to be the big guy anymore. He would have had the view of serving his people rather than dominating them because saved himself a lot of trouble. But he saw the nature, so he set up the golden calves, not because he's particularly concerned about golden calves. Anything would have worked, but the golden calves would have been as good as anything, so he set up golden calves specifically to keep the people from going to worship at Jerusalem. You understood that? Well, there's another guy who understands it too, and I should have put a picture of this in. How many of you have seen the Ark Encounter lit up at night? Yeah. With those rainbow colors? Say what you want about Ken Ham. He understands symbols. I'm glad somebody knows around here. The man understands symbols. Yes, John.
Are statues inherently idolatrous?
Not at all. Not inherently. And I think the case that I make for that is the statue that was made of the snake. You know, they had to look to the snake, but as long as it represented something else, it didn't represent the snake, it represented deliverance from the snake. It came from God himself. It went past the snake.
Okay, statues
not idolatrous.
How about statues of men?
Inherently idolatrous. If you're going to say statues of men are idolatrous, then I think you can't stop that at photographs of men. I don't think you can stop there. You just have to keep on going. Maybe embroidered picture of men. Growing up on my own, in our house, we had little statues family members, extended family members. My dad was a sculptor. He could do that kind of stuff. And we found them interesting, but really don't think anybody's ever said we really worship them. In fact, the better we got to know our relatives, might have gone the other way. Here's something for you to think about, too, though. And I meant to work this in my presentation, but I didn't. Thanks for reminding me, Jack. One thing that concerns me, and I will tell you, my all-time favorite statue is definitely Oliver Cromwell outside the British Parliament building, Bible in one hand, and he doesn't have a sword in the other, but he has a hand on a sword. Okay. But we don't see in the Old Testament under any kind of a godly economy that I know of, we never see a statue to a man. Ever. We just don't see it. I haven't worked out all the implications of that, but we just don't. We see pagans building statues that look like men and animals and who knows what. You ever see a really nasty looking image of Baal? It's horrible. And the other ones too. Fish gods, what are you talking about? Fish god. Philistines did that stuff. But I don't know anywhere in the Bible of a statue under a godly account, in a godly account to a person. Don't. It's one of the problems that the pagans have with King David. I don't know if you follow that or not. David didn't exist. What's their conclusion? Where part of it is, well, where's his? If he was that great, where are his images? Where are his statues?
And what about the 12 stones that they left on the riverbank, too?
Well, it's a symbol, and it's a definite monument. But I'm sorry, what do you would?
Well, I'm just saying, like, there is. I mean, that could, the 12 stones represent the 12 tribes, do they not?
Yes, no doubt.
It's representing humans.
Yeah. Well, it represents a human, but you're never going to mix up the stones for the humans. It's representing entities, if you will, not really humans. It's not representing any particular person in those tribes, if you will.
Right.
Just like the 12 stones that were on the priest's breastplate, if you will, representing all the 12 tribes. Same. It's the same thing. That's legit. All right. Well, hey, I thank you very much for your kind attention here for this challenging project. It could have been worse, right? We could have got in the vortex of the southern gentleman and so forth. But again, I'm telling you, I hate to see those statues come down. I hate worse what's happened to the next generation. Far worse.